Good afternoon, everyone. It being 12:15, we'll start our proceedings. I'm Rachel Callanan. I'm a clerk assistant with the Department of the Senate. One of the delights of my job is that I get to work with the wonderful team that puts together the Senate lecture series. Welcome to today's lecture. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the Canberra area, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and pay my respect to their elders past, present and future. Today's lecture is being live-streamed through the Australian Parliament House website and also via the broadcast system here at Parliament House. And the lecture is also being captioned. We usually have Auslan interpretation of our lectures, but unfortunately we were not able to secure the services of an interpreter for today's lecture. And while certainly disappointing for today, hopefully that's a reflection that Auslan interpreting is becoming more commonplace. If time permits, the lecture will be followed by a short Q&A session. Today, Friday the 15th of September, is the International Day of Democracy. Recognised by the United Nations and parliaments around the world since 2007, this day provides an important opportunity to reflect on the effectiveness of our democratic institutions and the state of democracy around the world. And therefore, I'm very pleased to welcome Ms. Lina Rikila-Tamang to deliver today's lecture. Lina is the Regional Director for Asia and the Pacific with the International Institute of Democracy and Electoral Assistance, known as IDEA. Lina has particular expertise in the field of democratic transitions and democratic backsliding in the Asia-Pacific region. In her role, she oversees IDEA's democracy support programs across the region. Since joining IDEA in 2002, Lina has supported several constitution-building processes throughout the region. She's also published on global democracy, women's political representation, and inclusive democratic processes. Lina is the former Secretary General of Finland's Advisory Board for Relations with Developing Countries. She also chaired the Network Institute for Global Democratization and has been a board member of the Asia-Europe Foundation. In today's lecture, Lina will draw on data from IDEA's Global State of Democracy Indices to reflect on the state of democracy in 2003, and also on Australia's role in protecting democracy within and also beyond its borders. Would you please welcome Lina Rikila-Tamang.
Thank you so much for inviting me and International IDEA to speak at the Senate Lecture Series. It is an honour. I also wish to acknowledge the Ngambri Ngunnawal people as traditional custodians of the land we are meeting on and pay my respects to the elders past and present and acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who may be attending or following this talk. As you may have noticed from my accent, I hail from Finland, specifically from Lapland, which is the home of the Sami people, Europe's only indigenous group. And in contrast to Australia, in Finland and broader Nordic region, we don't have the beautiful tradition of commencing the events or gatherings by acknowledging the traditional owners. Personally, I believe we should adopt such a practice. Unfortunately, we have very little symbolism in Finland that recognizes and honors the Sami people, their rights and rich culture. But it is essential to note that Finland's constitution does recognize the Sami people, and we do have a dedicated Sami parliament in place. The same is true in other Nordic countries like Sweden and Norway, which have Sami parliaments and institutions that uphold and protect Sami rights and culture. I will delve a bit deeper into these institutions later in my presentation. In many respects, the journey of reconciliation in Finland and in Australia has only just begun. As mentioned by Rachel, today is the International Day, Democracy Day, established by the United Nations General Assembly with the resolution adopted on 8 November 2007 to memorialize the Universal Declaration on Democracy. The date itself, 15 September, was proposed by the IPU, International Parliamentary Union. This year's theme, Empowering the Next Generation, focuses on the essential role of children and young people in safeguarding democracy today and in the future. Therefore, in the second part of my talk, I will focus on the parliamentary innovations around intergenerational justice, environment, and future generations, as well as on representation and inclusion of youth and indigenous peoples. But I will start by providing you with a sneak peek to the latest findings of the International IDEA's Global State of Democracy Indices and the forthcoming report, launching 2nd November in Stockholm, and highlight the state of effective parliaments in particular, globally and in Australia, in reference to the GSOD data. I should let you know, International IDEA is the only intergovernmental organization with an explicit mandate to support sustainable democracy. International IDEA combines a diverse membership of countries, including Australia, but also India, Indonesia, Mongolia, and the Philippines from Asia and the Pacific region, and has a status as permanent UN observer. We work with multilateral and national actors, including parliaments, but also democracy defenders and civil society in harnessing global action to defend and advance democracy. And our Asia and the Pacific regional office is located here in Canberra at the ANU campus. The global state of democracy in 2023 is fluid, complex, and unequal. And the intensity of those democratic gains that had deemed so promising has dulled over the past two decades. In 2022, our data shows that countries with net declines in democratic performance have outnumbered those with net advances for the past six consecutive years, with 2021 the worst year in record. Over the last 5 years, the most widespread significant declines in democratic performance were observed in elections, parliaments, and judiciary, the very key institutions meant to serve as checks and balances to the executive. On fundamental rights, globally speaking, the overall declines were not significant, but stagnation at the low level is not a situation to celebrate or tolerate. Moreover, many countries experience declines in the rights of expression, assembly, and association, sometimes connected to deterioration in security. In such contexts, the fundamental enabling conditions of democracy, including opportunities for debate and dialogue, are at risk of disappearing. And over time, such circumstances would wear down the ties that bind people together, potentially impacting civic engagement as people are less able and willing to risk their security to be active members of the society. But there are a few green shoots of hope. After many years of stagnation in levels of corruption, the data finds that there were improvements in this area in countries across all regions of the world in 2022. This picture here is, however, dampened by the fact that as many of the countries making progress on corruption, they are also suffering significant setbacks in other aspects of democratic governance. Nevertheless, the trends here highlight opportunities to learn and implement new approaches to counter corruption. Africa leads with the largest number of country-level advances, followed by Asia and the Pacific and Europe. Public participation remains the brightest hope for the future of democracy. It has remained at surprisingly high level, even in countries with a low level of democratic performance at an institutional level. The resilience of people's commitment to making their voices heard, even in the face of physical danger and political instability, as witnessed from Myanmar to Iran, is heartening. Across the diverse countries of Asia and the Pacific, a broad decline in democratic quality appears to have halted, with the significant exceptions of Afghanistan and Myanmar. However, civic space remains under threat as freedom of expression, press freedoms, and freedom of association have declined across many countries. After peaking in 2011, freedom of the press has now reverted to 1999 levels. And across the region, ineffective parliaments and crackdowns on organized civil society have left judiciary, anti-corruption commissions, and at times mass street protests, even military restraint, as the key constraint and balancing mechanism. Democracies in the Pacific, which is a renewed focus of geopolitical tension between United States and China in particular, saw no significant declines, but in years to come, they may see their institutions tested by these outside pressures. In short, democracy is still in trouble, stagnant at best, and declining in many places. Before zooming in what the indices say about the state of effective parliaments, just a few words about the global state of democracy, what it is and what it measures. At International IDEA, we understand democracy as a broad concept and one that can have many different manifestations depending on particular society's history, culture, and set of priorities. And although there are core tenets of democracy, the way these are operationalized and the way they look in different places can vary widely. There is no such thing as perfect democracy. Since 1975, we have measured the extent to which a country has realized aspects of democratic ideals in four broad categories: representation, rights, rule of law, and participation, and their sub-attributes. The goal is really to assist policymakers, analysts, scholars, journalists, and civil society to assess and to compare the quality of democracy. The indices can also be used to monitor progress on sustainable development goals, including the SDC 16, which measures also progress on effective and accountable institutions at all levels. While some of primary data collection is conducted within International IDEA, the majority of the data are taken from 20 other publicly available data sources, varieties of democracies, data set being the largest. And the data set and the documentation are freely available to download from the International IDEA website. And what is perhaps noteworthy is that unlike many other global democracy indices, we also measure aspect of basic welfare, denoting the extent to which there is an access to fundamental resources and social services, such as citizen access to nutrition, social security, healthcare, and education. GSOD is also largely an expert assessment. It does not measure people's perceptions on democracies or people's trust on institutions, like, for example, the world's value democracy does, value survey does. But we have recognized this gap and, in fact, are adding people's perceptions index to complement the overall analysis in the coming year. This year's report will be focusing on the role of what we call countervailing institutions in stopping the erosion of democratic institutions. The term goes beyond the traditional understanding of checks and balances to encompass those governmental and non-governmental institutions, organizations, and movements that check the aggrandizement of the executive and balance the distribution of power. It includes relatively new institutions like human rights commissions and electoral management bodies, as well as civil society organizations, popular movements, and investigative journalists that play irreplaceable role in ensuring that democracy continues to be of and by the people. What is positive is that in many places of weakened democratic foundations, such countervailing institutions like anti-corruption commissions have been able to step in. What is worrisome is that some of the formal countervailing institutions, particularly the traditional checks and balances, have been suffering. Over the last 5 years, the world has witnessed the most widespread, significant declines in two of the bedrocks of democratic governance, credible elections and effective parliaments. As worrying as these institutions serve dual purposes, they are both at the heart of thriving democracies and key to mitigating decline. And critically, these declines in effective parliament are a reversal of a long-standing positive trend that held until only a few years ago. Legislators should be the first line of defense against executive overreach. It is here where elected political parties and representatives can, if the need arises, investigate and sanction the executive branch. The legislative branch is also where elected representatives work to reflect people's needs in laws and system design. In many contexts, electoral processes have been marred by disparities in fairness, the exclusion of marginalized communities, the weakening of the electoral management bodies, and irregularities in voting and result tabulation. And these challenges undermine the essential role of elections as mechanism to hold unresponsive government accountable, people's power to throw their rascals out if they so wish to. Furthermore, these problems are exacerbated by weak parliaments that find it challenging to curtail excessive actions by the executive branch, trend that we have noticed strengthening, particularly after the pandemic years. In our methodology, when we assess the effectiveness of parliament, we gauge its ability to oversee the actions of the executive branch. So this particular indicator is not measuring, for example, how representative or inclusive the parliament is. As mentioned, over the last 5 years, parliaments have struggled to exercise their oversight functions, and significant declines have impacted countries across the political spectrum. Outside of extreme political crises, like the wave of military coups in Africa or the one in Myanmar, some high-performing democratic countries such as Japan and Slovenia, and mid-performing nations such as Argentina, Greece, Nigeria, India, Nepal, have also seen drops in parliamentary effectiveness over the last 5 years. In contrast, the European region offers inspiration, with 5 of the region's 12 countries demonstrating advances in the effectiveness of parliaments over the last 5 years. High-performing Czechia, Slovakia, Bulgaria, and mid-range-performing Moldova and Armenia have all seen improvements. Turning now to Australia, which remains high-performing democracy in every measure except civil society. While remaining well above the global average score in absence of corruption, Australia is yet to regain its standing following declines observed beginning 2012, which revealed weak regulatory structures in combating foreign bribery and public sector corruption. Important to note that our data is not yet capturing, for example, the formation of the National Anti-Corruption Commission, which started its work only this year. There are also declines in some other aspects, like media integrity, this likely due to Australia's concentrated media ownership regulations. In realm of effective parliament, Australia is the top performer among these peers, US, UK, Canada, and New Zealand. The United States, despite the serious drops in 2015, still sits slightly above Canada, which may look a bit surprising, albeit is what can be called trouble at the top. All these countries, globally speaking, are performing relatively well, albeit not improving, underlining the fact that there is no place for complacency. Representation measures, in addition to effective parliament, five other aspects: credible elections, inclusive suffrage, free political parties, elected government, and local democracy. In comparison to its peers, Australia is doing well. New Zealand features on the top, closely followed by Australia, UK, and Canada, US well below the other four here. However, regarding the civil society, Australia is behind these other four countries. This aspect assesses to what extent are civil society organizations free and influential, to what extent voluntary, self-generating, and autonomous social life is institutionally possible. Again, just want to underline that GSOD is largely an expert assessment, not that of people's assessment. We can see that parliaments play a critical role in ensuring democratic governance and, importantly, accountability. It is the cornerstone of a functioning, healthy political system. So let me now turn to some of the innovations where and how parliaments can be sources of rejuvenation of democracy, particularly on when it comes to inclusion and representation of future generations, youth and Indigenous peoples, and finding solutions to some of the most pressing challenges of our time, like climate change. As we know, the short-term nature of election cycles provides little incentive for political leaders to sacrifice immediate benefits in favour of long-term future goals. There is also the challenge of underrepresentation of some groups in decision-making, such as young people, Indigenous peoples, and women, even when the decisions most affect them. Some innovations seek to extend some kind of democratic representation to future generations and even non-human others, using proxies or trusty representatives who can speak for these unrepresented entities. Others try to deepen democratic participation through greater public deliberation between citizens, experts, and stakeholders to inform decision-making by law and policymakers in Parliament. Parliaments have developed different institutions that suit their system of government. They can be broadly organised in three categories. Number one, parliamentary committees for future, independent parliamentary commissioners, and citizen assemblies. The number of parliamentary committees of the future or for the future is increasing, as is cross-national collaboration evidenced by the first World Summit of the Committees of the Future, held in Helsinki 2022, the next conference to be held in Uruguay this year. And a study made by Finland's parliament discovered that out of 80 countries they looked at, some futures-related work was done in 43 parliaments around the world. Of these, eight were assessed to have so broad a mandate that they matched the idea of a committee of the future, even if operating under some other name. So some of the examples include Finland's Committee for the Future, which was established already in 1993, on the initiative of representatives in the then parliament and placed on permanent footing by constitutional amendment. It has 17 members, all MPs selected after each election. The committee does not reactively examine legislative proposals, but rather takes a proactive approach and focuses on identifying broader, longer-term issues that affect the future, usually by undertaking thematic studies. Some of the questions the committee has decided to work on are, how can we, the people of today, help the people of the future to achieve balance between human activities and the limits of our planet? How can we secure people's access to reliable information? How to spread the training of future skills, our cognitive structures, values, and beliefs of what is possible? And the time frames they have said are not only in 10 or 20 years, but also in 100 years. The committee is interested in increasing understanding on whether someone living in 2223 experiences their body and physical well-being or health, as well as humanity and communality, in the same way as someone living in 2023. And what I found so interesting, the questions asked by the parliamentary committee: what does it mean for the individual to have a good future, and of what is hope born? Examining the future also at the level of individual is one of the priorities selected by Finland's Committee for the Future. Germany has a permanent parliamentary advisory council on sustainable development, established in 2004. Its legal basis is in recurrent decisions of the parliament each term, and the council has 17 members drawn from all factions of the parliament. An important part of its role is to evaluate sustainability impact assessments, which must accompany all government bills. The Council describes itself as a watchdog. As they themselves say, it barks as soon as an initiative fails to bear in mind the national sustainability strategy. In Uruguay, the Futures Commission is examining the future of work and the work of the future. In Canada, the committee plans to look into deep technologies such as artificial intelligence, as well as the role of technology in helping manage migratory movements resulting from various types of crises. In Iceland, the committee is looking at the future of democracy and demographic transition using strategic foresight and scenario planning. A second innovation is parliamentary independent commissioners. These are independent experts, some of whom serve as officers of the parliament, established to represent the interests of entities not represented in parliament, such as the environment or future generations. The role of a commissioner is to bring sustainable development, intergenerational justice, environmental protection to the heart of the parliamentary lawmaking and government policy, counterbalancing the short-term focus of parliament. Some commissioners are also set outside the parliament, for example, in government ministries like the Malta's Guardian of the Future, or as a separate body, the Future Generations Commissioner for Wales. Wales is the only country in the world that has an act on well-being on future generations. This institution in Wales is attracting a lot of interest around the world, but as it is not connected to parliaments, I will not discuss it here more, but I encourage anyone interested to check them out. They have a very beautiful website. One example that is more closely tied to Parliament is New Zealand's Parliamentary Commissioner for Environment, which was established already in 1986 under the Environment Act. At the time it was established, the Commissioner was unique in the world. As an officer of the Parliament, alongside with the Auditor General and the Ombudsman, the Commissioner for Environment reports directly to the Parliament as an independent and non-partisan advocate for environmental management. The Commissioner may investigate matters where the environment may be or has been adversely affected and advise on preventative or remedial action. The Commissioner may also be asked by the Parliament to report on draft legislation or conduct inquiries on matters significantly affect an environment. Israel and Hungary have also established independent commissioners. However, these examples show the vulnerability of commissioners to watering down by political actors over time. In Israel, the Commission for Future Generations was established in 2001, but it worked only up to 2006, when no new commissioner was appointed to replace the inaugural one. And the office was dissolved by law in 2010. One of the reasons given for the end of the commission was that MPs felt that they, representatives of the people, have the free choice to decide what is good or bad for future generations. In Hungary, the status of the commissioner has been changed, or rather downgraded, over the years. A third category of innovative process is climate-focused citizen assemblies. A citizen assembly is a mini-public, or mini-representative group of citizens, usually randomly selected to ensure wide representation, who gather together over an extended time to discuss and propose solutions to important and complex public issues. These are organized to promote deliberation by presenting information from experts, then facilitating discussion among delegates to reach solutions that reflect wider public interest. And there is a growing number of citizen assemblies tasked with deliberation on the issues of climate change, generating a lot of comparative knowledge on what they are and how they are most effective. There exists, for example, a knowledge network of climate assemblies doing work on this, and closer to home, interesting work done by Nicola Curato from Center for Deliberative and Democracy, Deliberative Democracy and Global Governance at the Canberra University. As the map shows, the citizen assemblies on environment have been held country and city level, mostly in Europe, with few elsewhere. Apart from climate change, citizen assemblies, including what is called deliberative polling, have been organized in Iceland, in Ireland, and Mongolia in context of constitutional amendments. Most are set up as one-off, ad hoc assemblies, although the UK Sustainable Development Commission has made a proposal for a standing citizens' assembly called the Congress of the Future. This Congress, composed of randomly selected citizens, would be convened by Parliament once a year. The government or Parliament would put the issues in need of debate before each Congress to deliberate. And the Commission suggests that the Congress of the Future would provide, I quote, long-term thinking enshrined at the heart of our democratic process, raising awareness, creating political space, and generating action on the biggest issues of our time. The Congress of the Future is a way of giving adequate attention to the long term in what has become an overwhelmingly short-term political world. End of quote. This example, although not put into practice, is interesting as it creates a standing link between the Citizens' Assembly and the Parliament. Innovations in representation and inclusion of underrepresented groups. As per the Interparliamentary Union study, the global proportion of MPs aged under 30 was just 2.6% in 2021. Young people are typically underrepresented both in the electorate and in parliament. The reasons for this include high minimum voting age, power positions concentrated among older, established citizens, and in many parts of the world, an aging population in accounting for a growing proportion of voters, and frequently lower voting engagement of the young generation in jurisdictions where voting is not compulsory. And possible reforms include lowering the voting age, usually from 18 to 16, under debate and discussion in New Zealand and Canada, and a reality in Austria, Brazil, and Scotland, for example. NGOs and other organizations increasingly work to involve children and young people in their decision-making. Some ways in which parliaments may also do this include youth advisory panels, many public and private organizations, including policymakers and governments, have youth advisory panels to provide advice on issues affecting young people. Youth parliaments, forums for young people that replicate parliament, are fairly common. The purpose is usually educational, producing participants with knowledge and experience in how parliaments work. But they can also work to highlight the policy issues and solutions prioritized by young people. One concern with these kinds of models is that they are a bit top-down, distant from the real decision-making and the challenge of translating listening into action. Some countries have quotas to increase the number of young people in parliaments. For example, in Kenya, 12 MPs are nominated by political parties to represent special interest groups, which include youth as well as other categories. In Uganda, 5 seats are reserved for people under 30 years of age. And in Rwanda, 2 MPs are elected by National Youth Council. Quotas that operate through party lists are found, for example, in Lithuania, in Mexico, and in Sweden. Indigenous representation has received a lot of attention in Australia with the proposal for the Indigenous Voice to Parliament, a constitutional change to be put to referendum on 14th October. Examples of parliaments that include or work with Indigenous representative bodies are many. As mentioned in the beginning of my talk, Sami parliaments exist in Norway, Sweden, and in Finland. They are established by legislation and are elected by voters registered by Sami electoral roll. In Norway, the Sami parliament is an independent body to develop policies based on its mandate from the Sami people. It is the prime dialogue partner for the Norwegian government in its Sami policy and has administrative responsibility in matters concerning language, culture, and education. In Sweden, the Sami parliament has a dual role as a body of elected representatives and as an administrative agency to state to administer certain government programs. In Finland, the Sami parliament, founded in 1996, may put initiatives and make proposals to Finnish government authorities, particularly on what it comes to issues of language, culture, and education. For the last several parliamentary terms, the Sami parliament has been proposing amendments to the voter roll eligibility criteria, as well as on regarding the mandate of the parliament. These proposals are hopefully moving forward during this current parliamentary tenure. Other interesting examples include Vanuatu, Marshall Islands, where the parliament can, on certain issues, and can, or on certain issues, must consult Council of Indigenous Leaders regarding lawmaking or appointments. It is to be noted that Parliament in both these countries is not bound by law to accept the changes or recommendations, only to consult. As these examples show, Australia is not alone in developing innovative ways to recognise and include Indigenous peoples in law and policy making. Other developments in Indigenous representation draw on special measures such as reserved seats or quotas to guarantee the representation of Indigenous peoples in Parliament. Examples of reserved seats are in New Zealand, of course, where the Maori Representation Act requires that 4 members of the House of Representatives be Maori, elected by Maori voters. And Colombia, where 2 senators are elected in special national constituency for Indigenous communities. An example of quotas through an electoral system is Nepal, where the constitution requires parties to ensure representation through a closed list system for various groups, including indigenous peoples and women, on the basis of population. These examples I have given focusing on inclusion of youth and indigenous peoples in many ways echo the older debate on gender equality, yet to be fixed as well. And parliaments are uniquely placed to address the current challenges and advance gender parity, not only through the numerical balance of women and men, but through the type of decisions made by all members of parliament. MPs, whether they are women, men, or non-binary, can use their oversight and legislative scrutiny to eliminate gender discrimination, even if it's unintentional or indirect, and ensure that the actual impact of laws, policies, programs, and funds on women and men is monitored. A gender-sensitive parliament can respond to the needs and interests of women and men alike and remove barriers to women's full participation. An updated definition from Sonia Palmieri in a guide for parliaments demonstrates that parliaments must move from passive responsiveness to an active pursuit of gender equality. I quote, "A gender-sensitive parliament values and prioritizes gender equality as a social, economic, and political objective, and reorients and transforms a parliament's institutional culture, practices, and outputs towards these objectives." End of quote. Examples around the world are many, but just to mention a few, Timor-Leste, a parliamentary resolution in 2009 requires all parliamentary committees to use and promote gender budgeting instruments and methods and establishes a parliamentary process that assigns roles to the different actors involved. Each budget is now accompanied by a gender statement. The Swedish Riksdag doesn't have a specific committee on women's rights or gender equality, as all committees are responsible for considering gender in their respective fields. The Speaker's Gender Equality Group promotes gender equality internally through training, research, events, and support to individual MPs. The Fiji Parliament was among the first to include gender scrutiny in its standing orders. The standing orders require all committees to consider gender equality to ensure that the impact on both men and women is explored in all matters. Every committee report contains a gender analysis section. Ireland had a citizen assembly on gender equality as per the particular request by the parliament, and it submitted its report by the citizen assembly that I mentioned before in 2021. Fair to say, global gender equality hangs in balance, and parliaments need to play their part. Gender equality and inclusion is essential to rejuvenation of democracy. To conclude, while Australia consistently ranks as a high-performing democracy, according to global indices, there is no room for complacency. Civil society in particular is an area with room for improvement. Australia's peak on democratic performance was in 2012. Today's global challenges demand longer-term planning than the conventional lifespan of a parliamentary tenures. Democracies must not only to ensure that their parliaments remain effective and representative, but also pioneer new avenues for citizen engagement, including drawing and learning from Indigenous practices. I have discussed just a few examples of innovative approaches by diverse parliaments to improve the engagement of both current and future generations in decision-making. The pressures facing representative democracies are both real and widespread. The declines in electoral integrity and the effectiveness of parliaments, which are the bedrocks of representative democracy, serve as a warning sign. At the same time, democracies must prove their ability to address existential crises like climate change while ensuring decent living conditions for all. The Asia-Pacific region, our region, confronts a multitude of challenges, including economic recession, rising food and fuel prices, and growing inequality, contributing to social tensions. Alongside these issues, there are concerning declines in various aspects of democracy, from fundamental rights to shrinking space for civic engagement, as well as challenges to electoral integrity, parliamentary effectiveness, and judicial independence. Australia's new development policy rightly emphasizes support for civil society and climate change mitigation in our region. However, for civil society to thrive, we must also strengthen core democratic institutions, such as parliaments, judiciaries, anti-corruption commissions, election management bodies, and human rights commissions. These institutions are vital safeguards for protecting democracy and ensuring equitable representation. We must heed the voices of democracy defenders, civil society groups, youth, Indigenous peoples, and regional parliamentarians. Thank you so much for your attention.
Lena, thank you so much for your very interesting presentation. We do have time for questions. If anyone has a question, I just ask you to please put up your hand. And we've got two people on either side of the room who will bring a microphone to you. Is anybody interested in asking a question? I think we have a gentleman in the middle here and down here.
Yes, thank you very much indeed for your talk. Very interesting, so much to take in. Could you please comment on the relationship between democracies and constitutions? In that not all democracies have constitutions, and I imagine there are some places with constitutions without democracies. How important is a constitution to a democracy?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Most, as you rightly mentioned, not all democracies have written constitutions. Most democracies do have a set of legislations and conventions that can be considered to serve the purpose of the constitution, like UK. But most of the new emerging democracies, particularly after the third wave of democratization since 1990s, I don't recall any country new democracy that would exist without a constitution, and often the constitution building process being the very moment of agreeing of the democratic principles, the democratic setup, the institutions, all the basic rules of governance, the type of parliamentary system, presidential system, or semi-presidential system in some cases. Decisions are made regarding the electoral system, and very particularly on the topic of today, regarding the rules and principles regarding representation and inclusion. And what are the principles guiding that? And those moments of constitution building are very, very important ones. They are the kind of the window of opportunity. Often after transitions, democratization processes often happen either after collapse of the previous authoritarian regime, be it a military one or otherwise undemocratic governments, or after civil wars. And those are moments, very important moments, that may last for several years, where the nations come together and really debate and discuss the basic principles of democracy. So I do believe that constitutions are the kind of... The constitutions are the fundamental law, and in many ways they are what we can call a social contract between people and citizens and the government of how to govern the country. But there's a lot to say about the constitutions and democracy, but I do believe that There can be certainly democracies without constitutions. Those are normally the older nations, and there can be constitutions which are not democratic. That is also very much true.
Thank you. And our questioner here.
Hi, my name is Lorraine Finlay. I'm from the Australian Human Rights Commission and was particularly pleased to hear your comments about the important role of human rights institutions, but concerned about the comments you made in terms of Australia's decline in civil society engagement, and was wondering if you had any comments about any particular factors the report identified as leading to that decline, but in particular whether there are any innovative examples from other places around the world where steps have been taken to improve space for civil society and to strengthen that engagement that Australia might want to consider.
Our global, the State of Democracy Indices, the main purpose really is to produce the data for the countries themselves as an input to debate and discuss, particularly what you mentioned, the reasons behind the data, why the declines, why the advances. We, as International IDEA, we then try to extract more like a regional and global trends and analyze it at that level, rather than going into sort of a country discussions of apart from examples and some case studies that we do. So, like for example, in case of Australia, we hope that this finding is kind of our contribution to the debate to try to assess why is that. I mean, of course, civil society engagement, globally speaking, in Australia is doing relatively well, but is not amongst the high performers of the world, as one may expect Australia to be. So that was interesting finding, but I cannot really say why is that. It is our kind of data finding for Australian society, to civil society and others to debate about. But in terms of other examples or where the civil society participation is high performing, most countries are from Europe, but not only. And they are some of the particular efforts. Some of them are what I mentioned in my talk, some of the citizen assemblies, the consultative bodies, different consultation and participation processes that have been put in place. I mean, of course, you have to have the basic legal frameworks, resources, funding, other encouragement in regarding the civil society organizations and civic engagement more broadly. And some of these efforts are actually quite old, or been in place for the last, say, 10, 20 years at least, but they are not yet mainstreamed. Like a citizen assembly is something that is provoking a lot of interest and debate around the world, and they exist, but they are not yet mainstreamed in many parts of the world, and it may take still another 10, 20 years to take root. Thank you.
I think we've got a question up the back. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the talk today. You touched on information reliability in your talk. And I just wanted to ask, what work has International IDEA done on information and reliability and political polarization, especially in the context of the rapidly developing digital environment?
Yes, in our new strategy, focus has been put on what we call digitalization and democracy, recognizing that digitalization is bringing about both a lot of positive as well as negative consequences. We are doing quite a bit of research on what it comes to what we call democracy-affirming technologies, the ways to increase citizen engagement, for example, to improve the electoral processes, to reach out. For example, to ensure that in many jurisdictions, migrants, out of country migrants are disenfranchised, exploring ways of expanding voting rights for everyone, making use of technology, but then also increasingly recognizing the potential negative influence and impacts of digitalization to democracy. We are to explore the future potential use of artificial intelligence on elections, for example. There are real dangers, for example, regarding the voter secrecy that artificial intelligence may pose. It is a whole new work stream for international IDEA as well, and welcome any thoughts and ideas and new partners to work on this area.
I think we do have time for one further quick question before I do a wrap-up, if there were any more questions. Just got one person down here.
Hi, thanks so much for sharing today. It's been really interesting and a fabulous day to be having this conversation. I've often wondered about the extent to which Australia shares a physical border with other countries. The fact that we don't actually changes the dynamic around pressures that we might be under undertake particular sort of policy initiatives or put in place certain strategies. Does your data look at whether countries or states are sharing borders with other nations? Is that part of the data set that you collect?
No, we don't have the particular aspects of looking at the borders as such. We do look at more broader global threats that affect everyone, be it economic recession or climate crisis or any other of these challenges of global nature. Often countries, of course, if they share the border with one another, they tend to look at the sort of closest neighbors for inspiration in terms of practices and experiences or innovations. But as I mentioned in my talk as well, Australia often compares itself, perhaps for historical cultural reasons, with the countries like New Zealand, US, UK, Canada, some of them which are very far from Australia's shores. And at the same time, of course, Australia is part of the Asia and the Pacific region, and what is happening in the region is also affecting Australia and vice versa. But unfortunately, we don't have that particular angle in our study. Thank you.
Okay, thank you again, Lena, for sharing this special day with us and for your presentation. A recording of the lecture and information about future lectures will be available on our lecture series webpage on the Parliament's website, aph.gov.au. I hope you can join us for our next lecture on Friday the 3rd of November, presented by Romilly Malik. Mr. Malik is a commissioner with the Productivity Commission, a Jagan man, and member of the Yaru people. You can find details about that lecture online. And if you're not already subscribed to our mailing list, there's a subscription sheet at the exit table, or you can email us at research.sen, that's S-E-N, at aph.gov.au. And once again, could I ask you to all join me in thanking Lena for her presentation?